Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson. This Justin Bieber lookalike and a powerful advocate for liberty.
I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family. But I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about...
Freedom!
Your freedom, no excuses on the Freedom Report Podcast. Welcome back to the Freedom Report Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Peterson, and my guest today is the inimitable Jeffrey Tucker. You cannot imitate this guy. He's the chief Liberty Officer at Liberty.me and the author of the new book, Bit by Bit. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
It's really great to be here, Austin. I'm talking to you from the offices of the Foundation for Economic Education in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, wow. That, you know what? I think they're probably my number one favorite economic think tank. Because they're just, they're not controversial, but like all of their work is so principled and well-researched, and I love the guy who runs it. I took an advanced Austrian economics course there for a week, and it certainly changed my life and educated me in ways that I had never, I'd never been exposed to so many ideas in such a way before. So
I didn't know that. You know, if he introduced me into this world of ideas too, it was Larry Reed, right? Lawrence Reed. Yeah. He was the president. And when I was 20 years old, he came to my college in Texas and gave a speech that, you know, it was one of those moments that you see in class day after day after day, but there's something about the speech. We talked about money and free trade, I think. I remember sitting in a chair thinking, oh my God, liberty is so beautiful. I want to dedicate my whole life to it. And that was it.
Yeah. I was so fascinated because, you know, I didn't get a whole lot of economic education growing up, but, you know, my libertarianism sprung from a sort of a conservative upbringing and an instinct towards freedom rather than sort of the intellectual basis. So it wasn't until sort of I went to a FI class that I really was actually, you know, introduced face to face to the radical ideas of Austrian economics, and I took classes from Israel Kirzner, and I was exposed to such wonderful ideas. Mario, there's a Mario, I forget his last name, but
Rizzo,
mm-hmm. Yes. And then I had the Steve Horwitz. That's where I met Steve Horwitz, and then subsequently, because of my connection to him from there, I was able to book him on Freedom Watch and Fox because I found that he was such a strong talent. And
you did that to him. You turned him into a celebritarian.
I did. I get to take credit for a few celebritarians I've been able to churn out for the liberty movement, and that's I think been probably my best contribution.
Do you know that I got a text message this morning from a young man who said, "I'm thinking about becoming a celebritarian. What do you think?" He said that to me. This is true.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm like, so this is what, a profession now?
I mean, I've sort of cobbled together in a half-assed way a sort of a profession of professional celebritarianism, I guess you could say. But it's a lot harder than you think. I mean, I would dissuade anyone from really, you know, trying to do what I do in a sense, not because of the competition, but just because it's a very difficult, lonely road sometimes, you know.
Well, and also, you know, I'm beginning to think, don't we need like a certification process?
I mean, we need licensing, yes, of course.
Can we just really have a pure laissez-faire so that anybody who wants to be a celebritarian can just walk in and be that? I mean, I don't know. What about quality controls?
Good point. See, this is how people like me were able to get ahead, was because there were no regulations. Oh man, it's funny that you say that though, because you know I know that Facebook is its own private company and stuff like that. But for a while it was for sort of laissez-faire with posting and stuff, and anyone was able to become sort of a celebrity overnight because of the way that the algorithm worked. But then they introduced they sort of clamped down in a way to stop people from doing that. And even in the marketplace, you know, there can be regulations. That just goes to show there can be self-regulations and things that don't involve true coercion. But no, anyways, we're dithering, Jeffrey. We're having way too much fun.
No, we're not. This is this is very important because you're talking about the stuff that matters. I mean, you know, we something happened, I think, sometime in the last 6 years that sort of blew apart the old world and introduced to us this new world with the app economy.
Yes.
And with digital media going on hyperdrive and you know we're entering into the middle stage of the digital revolution, and it's opened up so many new technologies, and this is really the point that I'm trying to make in this new book bit by bit is that the world that's emerging, you know, like on top of the physical world, is this new infinite world of digital technology. It's all being created by this sort of decentralized entrepreneurs working within basically a world of anarchism. You know, it's anarchy out there, and it's beautiful, and we're seeing things that we never thought were possible, and mainly the building of this beautiful P2P economy, which includes, you know, not just land and real estate and rentals and jobs and contracting and everything, but even money, which is why I focus so heavily in the book on cryptocurrency.
Yeah, well, I think you've blown away my first question with your response. You've answered exactly what I was going to ask. So let me move to my next question because I want to know what impact do you believe that digital currencies might have on the broader economy in the future? What kind of changes do you think we might see?
Well, you know, first of all, it does provide a kind of safe haven. I think it's a kind of a new gold. But, you know, just this morning I was looking at all of the, not just Bitcoin, but all of the altcoins, including, you know, Dogecoin and Darkcoin, Purecoin, and all the rest of it, Litecoin, and there's so many. There's something like 68 altcoins out there that have a genuine market price associated with them. And you know, this has all happened in the last few years. I mean, it's amazing how quickly the world is changing. What does it mean for us? I think it opens up the possibility of a world of real private currency. In other words, we now have an alternative to government currencies and government currency management. That's kind of epic if you think about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, from a public policy point of view, it's awesome to think about it because the unity of money in the state has been the source of mischief for like 6,000 years, you know? And if we can really sever that in a way that in a distributed system so that all people of the world, all people of the world can really choose a private market-based currency. And I don't see how states can sustain their current sort of robust shape.
That's what I was going to ask because, you know, a lot of us, we talk about ending the Fed and, you know, all the people who are in the liberty movement, maybe if they're sort of greenhorns, they might think, oh, well, we need to just get an act of Congress to abolish it. But isn't it really just more likely that it's going to become obsolete through competition?
That's the way I like to look at it. I mean, essentially, innovation is happening much more quickly than the state can keep up with it. There's also a really substantive reason why the state can't control cryptocurrency. It's because the states are always national and operate within the physical world based on jurisdictional geography. But like a cryptocurrency is a global, it's a universal digital good that operates outside of physical space. It's spaceless and weightless, and it lives on a distributed network, which is to say that it can never be taken down no matter what. I mean, you can have states gang up on millions and billions of copies of the blockchain, for example. So long as one exists somewhere, it can be recreated a trillion times within a matter of seconds. I mean, that's an awesome power, and I think it's in some way, if there is ever a time to be optimistic about the future of human freedom, it is now. And the biggest reason is the invention of the distributed network and cryptocurrency in particular.
Absolutely. Boy, that kind of stuff is so exciting to me. I know it gets into wonky territory and something that we libertarians really love, but I really do see this becoming more broadly accepted in the future, especially now because we see, I think PayPal is now, you know, accepting Bitcoins. I know Amazon has begun to. Isn't that right?
I don't think Amazon is quite in, but there's ways around it. You can use all sorts of gift cards. You can to get into Amazon. But of course, my favorite company is Overstock.
Yes, that's what I was trying to think of. Yes, Overstock.
Yeah, and as Patrick Byrne, the CEO of Overstock, is very much an innovator in the space, and he's on the verge of doing something really amazing in terms of you know, equity shares and his company through the blockchain. That's going to revolutionize securities markets, really, using the blockchain, even outside of Bitcoin. And he wrote the introduction to my book, so I was just really thrilled by that. He's a very interesting guy. You know, he was trained in philosophy, and he was a professor at Stanford University before he became a CEO of Overstock. So he's quite an epic figure and very much an innovator. But yeah, I mean, people could say that, well, consumer adoption isn't taking place fast enough. Well, you know, I think that that's probably true, but the infrastructure needs to be built a little bit more than it is right now. We're still in the early stages. I got back from a Bitcoin conference in Miami that had over 1,200 people there, and all the exhibitors are just so, there were so many, like hundreds of exhibitors of companies that are now into the space. We're going to see the first real sort of NASDAQ-style Bitcoin exchange opening up. In fact, I think that was announced today by Coinbase.
Yes.
So there's all kinds of infrastructures being built up. There's these organizations, these companies that are starting to use the blockchain for titling information, for titling property tiles in a way that's verifiable, non-forgeable, non-reproducible, and actually holds a chance of getting around the problem of state titles, which is not so much a problem in the U.S., but it's a big problem.
Absolutely.
Latin America and other places. And I myself, Austin, I don't know if you followed this, but I actually officiated at a blockchain wedding a few months ago.
What?
With a couple. Yeah. But instead of going to the state marriage license bureau, they just posted their vows on the blockchain, you know, and received smart gifts.
That is so beautiful and nerdy all in one.
No, this is the future. This is the future of dating and the world. You know, you first talk and then you text and then you go Facebook official. Then you get married on the blockchain. That's just the way it's going to be.
I love it. I love it. I'm so optimistic for the future, and that's why I want to switch topics here to ask you about a different topic that's a little more controversial. And I should say to everybody here, you should get Jeffrey Tucker's book Bit by Bit. Where's the best place to get it, by the way?
Oh, you can join liberty.me for $5.
Do it.
And download that book and about 200 others. Or you can go over to Amazon. Mm-hmm. It's doing very well there. And I think we're charging some exploitative price, like $8 there.
Okay, well, yeah, that's the capitalist exploiter. So let's talk about politics, Jeffrey, because, you know, you and I, we have a lot of insight because, you know, I'm in the Beltway, and you're sort of like the one who flows between, you know, you're welcome in every circle, you know, and so you and I tend to hear things maybe a bit more than maybe some of my listeners and some of the libertarian larger movement at large. So I'm sure they would love to hear our thoughts on this subject. There was a really big article yesterday that came out in the Washington Post. It was called Rand Paul's Daddy Issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just
I saw that, and
it was discussing Ron Paul and the potential that he might have for harming Rand Paul's candidacy in 2016. Now,
don't you love what the Washington Post calls harming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. But here's the thing:
it's like he might say something that's true, you know, and that would be terrible.
Before we get into the personality politics of this, I want to talk about libertarianism as a whole, Jeffrey, because you're like me, you know, we're optimistic, but a lot of libertarians tend to be very pessimistic, and so here was what my problem was, because I was listening to a speech that Paul was giving at the Mises Institute, and he was saying this is specifically what he said. He said, I'm trying to pull this up. He goes, sanity will not return to U.S. leaders until our financial system collapses, an event for which they are feverishly working. And by they, he means like the people in government. And then he says, before we can actually restore our liberties, we most likely will have to become a lot less free and much poorer, he wrote. So I was confused, Jeffrey, because if the only way to get our liberty back is after there's a financial collapse, and if the government is feverishly working for that, shouldn't we be supporting the government and be looking for a plot like a Cloward Piven situation here?
That is a funny kind of contradiction in this sort of way of looking at the world. You know, I consider it this perspective, you know, this sort of Armageddon style libertarianism to be, I don't know. Well, it's dreary. And it's also, don't forget that people have been predicting the great collapse now for about 50 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and what we're actually seeing, what we're really seeing in reality here is a new world that's being built before our eyes. I mean, people are actually being made freer right now, not through political reform, top-down political reform, or some weird catastrophic collapse or something like that, mm-hmm. but through innovating, you know, and spreading out digital technology and other things too, you know, enterprises of all sorts, mm-hmm. and things like homeschooling. You know, this is one of the reasons I founded Liberty. That me was to kind of crowdsource ideas on living a free life, and I don't think it's really sustainable for libertarians to sit around just like doing nothing but hating their lives and hating the present moment and just waiting for the collapse. That's certainly not the way I look at it. That doesn't necessarily mean that I think that politics is the answer either. I think the answer is that you have to sort of start building your own form of freedom. You know.
Right.
I think that's the better way to think about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people like the Washington Post article, right? They try to contrast on one hand, you know, the political ambitions of Rand with the apocalyptic vision of Ron, you know. But to me, there's really a third option, which is just get busy building freedom for yourself.
Mm-hmm. I guess I just. I'm young, you know, Jeffrey. I have a long future ahead of myself, and I can't buy into, you know, conspiratorial theories about a future collapse of the United States, and you know, because brought on by confrontation with Russia over the Ukraine. I'm turned off by the sort of the fear mongering that goes on, and I just you know, I wish that there was some way to sort of pitch a philosophy that is so negative on government, but is so positive for human individuality, and so we become in danger of what they accuse Republicans of just being sort of the party of no. Okay, Jeffrey, so we got cut off there, but I'm cutting this for us, so if anybody hears a little blip, that's what that was. But, no, I want to say, Jeff, I guess I wonder, is libertarianism just prone to fatalism because of how bad things are with government?
And I think you summed it right up. I mean, the problem is that once libertarians discover this thing called the state, mm-hmm. and they're enlightened about the massive damage it does to the world, you know, becomes a kind of an obsession, you know, and it's frustrating because you look around you and nobody else seems to see what you see, and you know, it can kind of depress you and overwhelm you, and it can like consume you, and even disable you, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of a tragedy. This is why, in all of my writings and all of my work, I've tried very hard to say that libertarianism isn't just about hating the state, mm-hmm. that might be important, but also just as important, if not more so, is to actually fall in love with liberty. And when you fall in love with something, you look for it, you want to be around it, you see it around you, you feel it, you smell it, you want to live in its midst. To be in love with liberty is really, I think, a more important mindset for libertarians to be in, because then you start looking for opportunities and you see the beauty of human interaction all around you, and then we can build up a real future, and we can make real positive contributions for ourselves, for those we love, and for the whole of society that way. And to me, that's the right outlook. And sitting around just bemoaning the present state of the world, mm-hmm. I don't think gets us where we want to go. I do believe in fighting injustice, absolutely. I don't want to be to ignore all the evils of the state, mm-hmm. but I think from the point of view of actually using our lives in a constructive way, libertarianism should be as much, if not more, about falling in love with freedom itself and finding it. And sometimes you do have to look for it, and you have to work for it, you know. But you have to start that process. Just being filled with dread and loathing, I don't think it's a very constructive way.
One thing that I've observed, Jeffrey, is that there seems to be. A bit of a contradiction in some of our leaders, the people, I guess, that you could say, you know, if that's even the right word, where there is a strangeness of opinion where they don't seem to hate all governments, Jeffrey. They just seem to hate the U.S. government. You know what I'm talking about. The people and the enemy of my enemy is my friend for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I get concerned because, you know, I have taken some slings and arrows from the Ron Paul Institute on foreign policy simply for having contradicted their dear leader on certain issues regarded to freedom for Ukrainians. Because I look at liberty as a universal concept. You know, I do consider myself an anarchist, Jeffrey, because in many ways, you know, because of open borders and certain things like that, mm-hmm. to me, a constitution is nothing more than a private contract between a group of individuals. And so, in a sense, that's why I guess, you know, I have to say sorry. I guess I'm a minarchist because I think that any institution that would enforce those laws would have the same effect as government. However, moving on. But I wonder sometimes that if Jeffrey, some people aren't confusing isolationist nationalism with libertarianism. Do you know what I'm saying?
That could be, and there's a reason for that, and I think it has something to do with intellectual history. Libertarianism grew out of a time and a place in American history that was very much also bound up with a kind of reaction against the New Deal. So it got caught up with sort of American constitutionalism and right-wing ideology generally. And it's been difficult to sort of untie those things, I would say, over the decades. I think Murray Rothbard tried his best to do it in the 1960s and to sort of globalize and universalize the longing for liberty and the libertarian intellectual trend. But still, I think we're fighting that. I mean,
Jeffrey, it's like, but here's the thing. It's like there's this strange confusion. I mean, we've sort of fomented hatred of the neocons in such a way and demonized them in such a way that it's become the sort of the preferred pejorative of the low information libertarian set. Now, when I say that, what I mean is that if for simply having expressed the idea that Ukrainians should not be encroached upon by the big government of Russia, that is somehow, you know, a neoconservative position or an interventionist position. Well, you know, for all this talk of secession that they had at this Mises conference the other day, Jeffrey, that, you know, they sure as hell don't support secession of the Ukrainians for a legitimate secession. No, they're busy defending Vladimir Putin and bashing the United States. I mean, that is what I was trying to say, Jeffrey. Is that
yeah.
I feel like there is an isolationist nationalist a portion of this America first, when it should be liberty first, and that the rights of all people all over the world, because borders are invisible lines created by politicians.
Well, not only that, but the borders are becoming less and less relevant. I mean, we're doing business every day, every second of every day, especially through the app economy, with people from all over the world. Our fates are all tied up with people. And this is, by the way, a theme I touch on in the book, because you know, I began with the story about the sort of longing of the old classical liberals for a global system of self-determination.
Mm. You're going to have all the globalist scum.
Yeah, right. But where every individual in the world is basically in charge of customizing his or her life and the kind of exchanges that take place therein. And I think that's where we're working towards. And I think it's a world where the nation state is less and less relevant. By the way, I just want to say one quick thing about this idea of sort of hating your own state more than you hate other states.
Yes.
I'm sure you've traveled a lot too, but I've found that this is true almost all over the world. Like people really hate their own governments a lot more than you might expect. You know,
right.
When I went to Brazil, I came back and I wrote an article that said something like, you know, in many ways, Brazil is a freer country than the U.S., you know. And I had Brazilians up in arms denouncing me for having said this.
Because, I
know. Yeah, they said, oh, no, this country is just a socialist nightmare and America is a free country. Well, and then the same thing happened when I went to Spain. I said, well, you know, in some ways, Spain is freer than the U.S. And the Spaniards were like, are you kidding? This place is a socialist dump, you know. And then I went to Australia, which has, you know, like this. And New Zealand, the same thing. This is like the second and third freest economies in the world. And I said, for God's sake, your economy is free. And people are like, how dare you say that? The tax authorities are all over us, or they're constantly confiscating our guns, and we have no civil liberties here. I want to move to America where you're really free. So, you know, I think this perception that your government is somehow worse than any other in the world is a kind of a universal thing. Yeah. And the other thing that tends to be a little bit universal is that visitors to other countries feel freer than they do in their own country. And the reason for that is that when you're visiting a foreign country, you're not really paying income taxes. You're not facing bureaucrats. You're just wandering around like a free person. And you feel what it's like. And it's a beautiful feeling.
That's true. Now, okay, so let me talk about one of the other topics that they hit on at the Mises conference that I had talked about on my podcast today. And I mean, 20,000 downloads already, and it's been up for like 2 hours. So it's really,
wow.
This is a hot topic. But secession and the principle of secession. Now, the principle of secession, now I know you don't care about laws and legality, like when it comes to like the United States government laws and things like that, as an anarchist, and you know, I respect your position. But as we understand it right now, from a secession from a moral perspective, secession to me, I think it's illegal, right? But it's not necessarily immoral. Now, secession to me can be illegal and immoral, and it can be illegal but moral. And what I mean that is that, for example, the secession of the United States from Britain, that was illegal, but it was moral. But to me, the Confederacy, the slaveholding governments of the South, who specifically stated in their own words that the reason they were doing so was to maintain chattel slavery, that to me was illegal and immoral. So I think, you know, there's this sort of blanket assumption under libertarianism that somehow local government is better government. And I have to explain to them, you know, yes, why, you know, there's this line from The Patriot, why would I trade one tyrant 1,000 miles away for 1,000 tyrants a mile away? You know, and so isn't it possible that secession can be illegal and immoral, Jeffrey, if the stated purpose in doing so is suppressing individual rights?
The way you stated that question, what you said is obviously true. And the only consistent way to favor secession is all the way down to the individual level. Mm-hmm. If you're seceding in order to oppress people, that is not in any sense a moral ambition. I completely agree with that. I mean, the Southern case was mixed in many ways. My general sense of things, and I'm not a historian of Civil War, but that the Deep South states did indeed secede in order to maintain chattel slavery, but that wasn't the ambition of Virginia, for example. So, you know, the other weird thing is that the American case is kind of mixed up with the states' rights issue, and it's unclear exactly, you know, to what extent the framers of the Constitution imagined that the states would be allowed to go and under what conditions. And, you know, I mean, Lincoln basically settled that issue through force of arms, of course. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's always going to be a mixed case. Not to mention the fact that the Confederacy developed its own massive central state.
Yes.
You know, instantly.
Yes.
And inflated the currency and drafted
yes.
troops
yes.
and
yes.
changed chattel slavery. So
yes, I mean, and that's the thing. I listened to the libertarians of criticism, and for a while I sort of joined in because it was kind of like a little group thing, fun thing. But then when I educated myself about the purposes of Mississippi, you know, for example, and Texas, what they said in their articles of secession, I had to ask myself, well, I don't have to necessarily be a supporter of Lincoln, but to say that that Lincoln crushing the slaveholding governments of the South was a libertarian end. He may not have used libertarian means, but it certainly was a libertarian end. Because Lincoln was crushing governments, the creation of more governments. And I guess what I'm really trying to get the point at here is that I think that sometimes libertarians confuse decentralization with libertarianism, Jeffrey. And I think that that's a mistake because, again, local government can be just as tyrannical, if not more, than federal government.
And actually, even local governments and even small companies and even families can be oppressive, you know? So here's the problem, and this is something we need to get clear about. The enemy is not just the state, it's the main enemy, but the real enemy to liberty is power of all sorts, wherever it may appear and in whatever form it may appear. And this is something I've sort of gradually had to come to realize. It took me a long time to come to terms with this, but it's an extremely significant and important realization.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Yeah, because I think that the problem is Jeffrey, is that we have, you know, a sort of confusion in the movement where the allegiance is to things like states' rights, and I'm like, I got to get, you know, pulled back from that because I don't believe states have rights. I think states have powers. Only people have rights.
Hey, you know, Austin, let me just kind of throw out. I don't know how much time you have.
No, please.
Yeah, but this is a very interesting thing to me because I'm actually been thinking about this a lot ever since Martin Luther King Day. Okay, so that was what, like a couple of weeks ago, or was it last week or something like that? And so I reread the letter from Birmingham Jail. And I know this sounds maybe a little bit silly and a little bit naive, but I was blown away when I read that document because I felt for the first time that I really got what the problem was and why the civil rights movement had to exist. And it's pretty darn simple. It's not about race war or anything like that. The problem was that a whole group of people are having their rights systematically abused all the time by the local and state government, you know? And they were not getting any kind of fair treatment from the police or the courts. And that's all the civil rights movement, really, that's the main thing the civil rights movement rose up to fight for. was the rights of a community to live in a free way, to determine their own fate, and to stop being muscled and abused and brutalized by the local police. Okay, so now, in the course of this letter from jail, by the way, he was in jail for not having a permit to march, you know? That was the whole reason. But he says something like, he says to me, like, you know, there are people who say that the civil rights movement is entirely motivated by what he calls outside agitators, or what the white racists at the time called outside agitators, you know? Right, right. So I began to think about this, because I think in the past I've made very similar points, like, well, the problem with the civil rights movement is that it relied on the federal government or state governments to come in and crush local governments, which makes it a little bit ambiguous. But, you know, when your rights are being violated, like every day, systematically, as a community, based on race, and in a way that's like nonstop, what do you want? You want this to come to an end through whatever means.
Right.
So if you have somebody from the, I don't care if they're from Washington or from Birmingham, you know, they're from, you know, some external force coming in and saying, hey, you love your way of life and that's fine, but your way of life cannot consist of violating the rights of others. You know,
right.
If you're Martin Luther King or you're a marcher on the Selma Bridge or you're, protesting, mandatory forced segregation in a southern town, you're very grateful for somebody to recognize your natural right. It's not as if an outsider is granting you some right you don't already have. What's happening is that your rights are being recognized for what they are, which are natural rights. I mean, that's what Martin Luther King's point was, that this is not an outside imposition of a different way of life. This is a matter of the local people who are tired of being brutalized, asking for just a simple concession of freedom. Like,
right.
Freedom, give us rights.
Again,
and there's nothing wrong with that.
I know. And let me bring it back to the Civil War again. You know, sometimes maybe I think libertarians have a little trouble empathizing, perhaps. Maybe we're a bit on the spectrum. But if you were a slave in the South, you don't care that Lincoln waged a bloody war. If I was held in a basement right? Do you think that I would give a damn that some, that the officers go and get a warrant to come and free me from this from my slavery?
That's right. So you're going to be in the basement, and some guy shows up, and he's from the neighboring town or a neighboring state, and you say, "Listen, I know that I'm being tortured and beaten down here, but my principles stand against centralized government forbids me from allowing you to save me."
Right.
That's just ridiculous. Hey, let me give just a real quick example here. Okay, just real quick, and we don't have to go on with this, but I think it's important for us to, like, sometimes whites have a hard time identifying with, like, black protesters in the 1960s. You know, it's all poisoned. The debate about all this stuff is, you know, continues to be confusing. So let's just try to reduce this to a little clearer level. Let's say that you're trying to homeschool your children. Right, you're trying to teach them reading and writing and everything at home, and they're 8 years old. And the local government comes and takes your children away from you and puts them in foster care and puts you in jail. Mm-hmm. Okay, and which is not an entirely unrealistic scenario. Let's say then Rand Paul is president, and he says to whatever state you happen to be in, let's just say it's Georgia, "I find this intolerable and abuse of rights, and I will not let it go on. And I order the local educational authorities to free these people right now and start recognizing their rights to homeschool." Okay, would you say that that is a net plus for liberty?
Yes, or would.
So I would too. I think anybody would. And the idea of getting, like, advancing the principle of decentralization to the point that is, like, it overlooks such obvious rights abuses is not consistent with a thoroughgoing liberal attitude or libertarian attitude. So with this scenario I just raised up is something you need to everybody needs to think about, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, do we have rights as individuals that are embedded in the structure of our lives that we're entitled to regardless of the regime under which we live? Mm-hmm. Or are we going to forever just make sure that the only enforcement of rights, you know, comes from our locally legitimately constituted governments, and they should be permitted to forever violate rights regardless because our principled stand against external intervention is so strict that we wouldn't permit any other solution? These are very important problems to think about.
They are, because I think that sometimes, you know, again, the libertarians automatically kind of assume, you know, state rights and decentralization necessarily means more freedom, but I don't know that that's the case. I mean, anti-government is usually the right way to do it, but if a government frees you, I mean, you don't necessarily look those gift horses in the mouth. I mean, it's to say that government is always evil, everything they do all the time, I think is not being objective, because, you know, if we were ever invaded by aliens, and all the government, I'm sure we would all be happy if our governments were working on our behalf. But that's a silly example. But
there's always the danger, and anytime government uses any power for anything, really. But I do think decentralization and general is a much better principle. I look at the history of freedom in Europe. I mean, it came about because of governments being the locus of government, the jurisdictions of government being so local that people could actually flee tyranny and go to the next town or whatever. And so there's a competition between states that gave birth to the Renaissance, really, and to our modern understanding of liberty. But all of that being true, I agree with you that our central principle is liberty. It's not decentralized government. Those are tied together historically, and I think decentralization is extremely important. But at the same time, I would say a much higher value in general is the universal rights of all people, men and women, blacks and whites, Muslims, Jews. That's what libertarianism is all about.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, and I knew that you would feel that way. I mean, I sometimes get a little bit – I sometimes despair, Jeffrey, just because I feel like there's so many fundamental misunderstandings and placements of concepts higher than liberty, as if you know, decentralized government was somehow, you know, always the answer. But No,
hey, there's a quick story. It's so fast. But Ludwig von Mises held two different views on this, one early in his life and one late in his life. In his 1919 book called Nation, State, and Economy, he saw nationalism, as you're describing it, as a force for good because it caused people to come together as a unity and resist central states and reestablish communities of politics under regimes that are most compatible with the democratic aspiration. Okay, so that was 1919. So 1944, he writes a different book called Government. And now he looks out at the world and says, holy, you know, this is horrible. What has nationalism come down to? Nationalism has become the enemy of liberty. It's become a source of tyranny and despotism, you know, all over Europe. The nationalist impulse is essentially contrary to the whole liberal idea. So he really, he more or less, I don't want to say he reversed his view. He qualified his view, or he matured in a way. 1919, he saw nationalism as being nothing but good. 1944, he saw it as an impulse, a violent and chauvinistic and wicked ideology that was warlike and dangerous, and really he wanted it to be crushed.
I can so understand understand this concept, and this is something that I struggle with, Jeffrey, because I consider myself above all things an individualist and a libertarian, but after that I do consider myself maybe a nationalist second or third. But to me, nationalism is only a means to an end. It can be a double-edged sword because it's the type of thing that it can cut you if you don't wield it properly. And I say this because it was nationalism that inspired the revolution that gave us the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the freedoms the relative freedoms that we do enjoy. So it can be a force for good, and it can also be a force for evil. Is it something about the people, or is it something about the leadership? I mean, why is it that it's such a double-edged sword? I mean, because it can be used for good, to rally people behind a good cause, but it can also be used to rally people behind an evil cause, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I just generally for myself am very, very suspicious of nationalist movements, you know, like white nationalists in Texas, you know, that want to secede. I'm like, you know, there's nothing liberal about that. I mean, here's the thing. Libertarianism has to be connected with the history of classical liberalism. And that sort of virulent, chauvinistic nationalism of any sort is essentially illiberal at its root. And that's why I think we need to be suspicious of that. I'm so uninterested in that impulse at this point.
I'm just a young romantic. I was just a boy when my dad took me to see Ronald Reagan, and I think, you know, I'm not bewitched by the flag waving, and I criticize the Pledge of Allegiance and all of that. But I guess, you know, people confuse love of country for love of government, Jeffrey, and it's not a love of government that I have. It's a love of my country, and so the symbols of nationalism, of the American national experience, to me are symbols, powerful symbols of freedom, and I know that they can be used for ill, but maybe I think that perhaps there's something romantic about me, and H.L. Mencken would have chastised me for my sense of optimism or the belief that it could be used for good.
This is the 21st century now, and I don't. This is one of the reasons I'm just, you know, I have no interest in the sort of right wing nationalist and forget American nationalism. I mean, there's nationalism of all sorts, you know.
Sure.
And like Mises identified in 1919, I think in the 21st century none of this stuff is necessary. Mm-hmm. I mean, our country is essentially the place where the values that we hold dear are held in highest esteem. And I'm quoting here Albert J. Nock. And he says, even if you've never lived there, that's where your heart is. And the beautiful thing about 21st century digital technology is that it allows us to kind of put together even, you know, our own kind of worlds. We're allowed to customize our values and see them realized and instantiated and real practical ways, peer-to-peer all over the world. I don't see much of a future for the nation state under these conditions. And I think the ideologies of nationalism are really very much outmoded in our times, especially for young people. I just can't see it. And I dread the next election. I would, you know, because of all this flag-waving patriotism and all the rest of it. So I never think it really amounts to much good at all.
Okay, well, don't yell at me if Rand Paul wins the presidency and you see me waving the American flag. And
hey, listen, you know, the Rand Paul issue is a fascinating one, because I find myself really on two sides of this, because you know, you read Facebook and you see all the haters out there, right? I mean, they're all over the place.
I know.
Yeah, and I guess my feeling is that if you regard politics as a consumption good and it really is something that you're driven to do and you feel like this is a really good venue for you, that you can realize that you feel like maybe you can make the country freer, or maybe you can't make the country freer, maybe you can prevent evil from happening, or maybe you just have an aspiration to change the nature of the debate within the Republican Party. God, wouldn't that be wonderful, right? So I'm never going to criticize anybody for being involved in these kinds of political campaigns. It's not really my thing. I'm more interested in technology. I'm more interested in sort of customized.
Oh, so if Rand Paul asked you to make you the Bitcoin czar, what would you say?
The Bitcoin czar. Well, if I had a chance to go in and unplug all the electricity at the Federal Reserve and stop the printing presses, I would certainly do it. Absolutely.
Oh, Jeffrey, God, we'll talk for hours, buddy. You are so fascinating, and I sincerely appreciate you coming on my show today.
So glad to be here. I look forward to seeing you at ISFLC, and I want to continue our conversation over some drinks. We always have a wonderful time.
Hope to see you there, Jeffrey, and we will definitely do another interview. Ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed the show, do me a favor, subscribe to the Freedom Report on iTunes. You can also get us on Stitcher. It's the application. Don't forget to check out Jeffrey Tucker's book, Bit by Bit, available at liberty.me. Do me a favor, ladies and gentlemen, if you like the show, 5 stars, 5 stars, 5 stars on iTunes. That'll help me spread the message of economic freedom and personal liberty at thelibertarianrepublic.com.